Today is Thursday, October 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, presidential debate organizers say they're working on changes following Tuesday night's performance.
The kinds of things that we saw in the debate are exactly the kinds of things that erode democracy.
A French court rules against extradition for the alleged Rwanda genocide mastermind. Also ahead, remembering a female pop vocalist whose biggest hit was way ahead of its time.
There was a time where there was all this zeitgeist is the only word I can come up with. There was just this feeling in the air that things were changing.
It's all on today's International Edition. The first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden resembled more of a shouting match than a structured exchange of ideas. Debate organizers say they're working on changes to ensure a more productive discussion for the candidates' next encounter. But analysts say the chaotic outcome of their first meeting is also a reflection of the country's deep political polarization. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara has the story.
Social media exploded with memes during the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden, with many viewers characterizing it as childish and as old men yelling at each other.
This is a left-wing white supremacist. This is radical left. Will you shut up, man?
There were plenty of personal insults.
Yeah, there's nothing smart about you, Joe. 47 years, you've done nothing.
Listen, you're the worst president America has ever had. Come on.
Jennifer Mercia is a professor of political communications at Texas A&M University.
The kinds of things that we saw last night in the debate are exactly the kinds of things that erode democracy, that in fact our democracy is at risk. And you can tell by the way that political leaders talk to one another.
Discussions about the pandemic, economic recovery, and racial unrest were drowned out by insults and interruptions and shocking moments such as when the president refused to denounce white supremacists.
Stand back and stand by.
Our street!
Proud Boys, a far-right group that engages in political violence, celebrated the president's remarks and created online memes with his answer. On Wednesday, Trump said he does not know who they are.
Over 200,000 dead, 14 million jobs lost, and Donald Trump spent an entire debate blaming others.
The Biden campaign launched a post-debate digital ad blitz highlighting Trump's remarks. While the Trump campaign claimed that the moderator and the media treated Trump unfairly in the debate and that Biden is weak. Tim Murtaugh is the director of communications for the Trump re-election campaign.
Joe Biden, who was put on his heels most of the time, spent a lot of time looking around for assistance from the moderator and sort of looking around for someone to bail him out.
Initial polls show that the chaotic debate did little to sway voters.
It was very disappointing for American democracy and the country as a whole. It was embarrassing, to be honest with you.
As campaigning enters its final weeks, both campaigns are trying to find voters they can still win over in the key swing states seen as most likely to affect the results. The remaining two presidential debates and one vice presidential debate are scheduled in October. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
The Presidential Debate Commission, which organizes and negotiates with each campaign on rules and format of debates, announced Wednesday that it will be adopting changes to help ensure more orderly discussions on the issues. Joining us now to talk about the changes is Clark University Professor Robert Boatwright, Chair of the Department of Political Science. Thank you so much for being with us. How unprecedented is it for the commission to make changes to debates that have already been negotiated?
Well, the commission has never done anything like this before in the middle of debate season. Before the debates occur, the candidates will agree to what's called a memorandum of understanding about how the debates are supposed to proceed. And those are lengthy, lengthy documents that include lots of very technical details, right? The size of the podium, who the moderator is, what the question format will be, all sorts of specifics. So these are things that are worked out months in advance, in some cases before we even know who the candidates are. So it's unprecedented for the commission to step in after one of the debates has happened and call for dramatic changes. In a normal year, either candidate could protest and say, this isn't what we agreed to. And there is, of course, the possibility that either candidate could do that at this point and just walk away. So the commission is gambling to an extent that the candidates will accept this, or that if somebody walks away, that it won't be that catastrophic for the commission or for the public.
We have had contentious debates where the moderators lost control before. How much is a moderator supposed to be responsible for, besides sort of just keeping things flowing and asking the questions and letting the two debate?
There's been a lot of discussion of how presidential debates can be improved for a number of years. A lot of different academic organizations or civic organizations have talked a little bit about how to reduce the power that the moderator has over the debate and how to create some sort of free-flowing discussion where the candidates get to give answers to each other, where they get to engage in each other, where candidates are really compelled to do something other than just give their stump speeches or talk about what they want to talk about. So there have been a variety of proposals in 2016, before the nominees were decided upon by the parties, there was a large discussion about what needed to be done to fix presidential debates. So that discussion isn't going to go away, but I think once Trump got the nomination in 2016, it was kind of put on hold. So we have this discussion about how to improve debates that I think will resume in 2024 or sometime in the future once Trump is gone. But I think after it became apparent in 2016 how he was intending to debate Hillary Clinton, I think all of these organizations kind of gave up on rule changes and thought, well, this is something we'll consider sometime in the future.
There were rules already set forth, but if the candidates don't adhere to them, what kind of mechanisms would the commission be looking at to ensure it doesn't go off the rails?
Well, the thing that people have been talking the most about regarding yesterday has to do with whether the microphones are turned on, you know, whether one candidate will have his microphone turned off while the other one is talking. That's not a rule that needed to be in place in prior debate. So all of the discussions we've had about rules presume that the candidates were mostly going to follow them. So it's hard to create rules to govern how candidates are going to behave if they break the rules.
Professor Robert Boatwright, Chair of the Department of Political Science at Clark University. Following the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Republican-controlled Senate is racing to confirm Amy Coney Barrett, President Trump's pick for a replacement. Democrats are expressing outrage about voting on a nominee as early voting in November's presidential election is already underway. In 2016, the Republicans refused to consider a Supreme Court nominee named by President Barack Obama, a Democrat, saying it was an election year and the nomination should be left to the new president. This time, Republicans say that since the party controls both the White House and the Senate, and Trump may win re-election, they should proceed with hearings. Joining us now is UC Hastings constitutional law professor Joel Paul. How unprecedented is it for a Supreme Court nomination this close to a presidential election?
It is unprecedented in so far as the voting is actually ongoing right now, and we will not know the winner until sometime after November 3rd. Nothing like that has happened before in our history. And it's particularly unprecedented because the leader of the Senate, Senator McConnell, has articulated previously a rule, what he called the McConnell rule, saying that there would be no votes on nominees to the Supreme Court in an election year where the president was going to be subject to election. So it seems unprecedented in that respect. On the other hand, the one example that I could think of in which a president after an election, in the period between the election and the inauguration, got to name someone to the Supreme Court is the case of President John Adams in 1801, nominating Chief Justice John Marshall to the Supreme Court. But there is a difference, and the difference is this, that in 1801, John Marshall was named to the Supreme Court because no one else wanted the job. It was at that time not a very important position. It was considered not an equal branch of the government, and Chief Justice John Marshall made it a co-equal branch of the government. But before him, it did not really matter who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So this is an unprecedented situation we are now in. In February of Mr. Obama's last year in office, Justice Scalia died. And President Obama nominated at that point Judge Merrick Garland of the D.C. Circuit. Merrick Garland is a judge who conservatives had repeatedly said that they would like to see a liberal Democrat put on the court because he is considered a moderate judge who sometimes votes with liberals and sometimes votes with conservatives. Nevertheless, when he was nominated, Senate Leader McConnell articulated what he called the McConnell rule, that the president should not be allowed to name a justice to the Supreme Court in his last year in office because it should be left to the voters. And now we have a situation in which the voters are actually already voting. And so the question is, why don't we leave it to the voters?
So basically, as long as whoever is president has the opportunity to nominate a Supreme Court justice who literally will be serving a life term, they can appoint that person. And in this case, the president has a Senate majority. It goes through the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the House of Representatives, which is currently the Democratic majority, really doesn't have any say. And the process, how does that work?
Yes, so the Constitution provides that the president can nominate members to the Supreme Court and to the inferior courts that Congress may create. The nominee then subject to confirmation process. Typically, there are hearings held by the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Senate Judiciary Committee then will vote the nominee out to the floor of the Senate, and the Senate votes. It had been the case up until the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh that the Senate had to have 60 votes in favor of the nominee because of filibuster. The filibuster rule was removed by Senator McConnell and the Senate Republican majority. And so now you simply need a bare majority of votes in order to confirm the nominee.
So following an iconic figure like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who recently passed away and who President Trump's nominee would replace, do you think she will actually be confirmed?
Well, in all likelihood, she will probably be confirmed, given the fact that the Senate Republicans have indicated all but two of them would be willing to vote for her. However, there is a lot of historical precedent for nominees who looked like a shoo-in being nominated by the president, who were then rejected in ways that were unexpected. Justice Fortas was nominated by President Johnson in President Johnson's last year as president, and Fortas seemed like an easy pick, given that he was already on the Supreme Court. He was nominated to be Chief Justice, but he was rejected by the Senate. Harriet Myers was picked as Associate Justice by President George W. Bush. She was rejected. And, of course, Merrick Garland was nominated by President Obama. So there are certainly, and there are many other examples I could give, of nominees who seemed like an easy shoo-in, and yet they did not make it. So we'll have to wait and see what exactly we learn about her family, about her finances, about her positions on issues, and whether or not she may be seen as too extreme for the Senate.
UC Hastings constitutional law professor Joel Paul. In 2016, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would not hold hearings for Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, saying the incoming president should appoint the replacement. This time around, he and other Republicans say the hearings should go ahead because the same party holds the White House and the Senate, and because Trump, unlike Obama, is running for re-election and could remain in office. A top French appeals court has refused to block the extradition of the alleged financier of Rwanda's 1994 genocide to a United Nations tribunal. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports France now has a month to extradite 84-year-old Felicien Kabuga to the court in Tanzania.
The decision by France's Court of Cassation is a blow to Felicien Kabuga, who was arrested at his Paris area apartment in May after a quarter century on the run. Kabuga's lawyers had appealed an earlier ruling that he should stand trial at a UN court based in Arusha, Tanzania. They said his health was poor and raise fears the UN court would be biased against him. But the Court of Cassation said it saw no legal or medical obstacle to Kabuga's transfer to Arusha.
La réaction du Bouquet France est une grande satisfaction qu'ils puissent enfin.
Etienne Nzanzimana, president of Rwandan Genocide Survivors Support Group, Ibuka France, hailed the ruling. Now he said it was time international justice played its role and end the years of impunity Kabuga had enjoyed. Once one of Rwanda's richest men, Kabuga is accused of bankrolling militia groups responsible for killing hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus. He reportedly founded and was heavily involved in Radio Television Mid Colline, whose incendiary broadcast fanned ethnic hatred. More than two decades ago, Kabuga was indicted by the UN Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda, or ICTR, on seven counts, including genocide. He denies all the charges as lies. Kabuga is to be tried at the Mechanism for International Criminal Tribunals, which took over from the ICTR after it closed in 2013. Rwanda said it wanted to have him tried in its own courts. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The World Health Organization reports anyone found to have sexually exploited and abused women seeking work in its Ebola aid operation in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo will face serious consequences. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Health Agency says it is outraged by these allegations. It says it has a zero-tolerance policy with regard to sexual exploitation and abuse and plans a thorough investigation to get to the bottom of this totally unacceptable behavior. An investigation by the New Humanitarian and the Thomson Reuters Foundation found more than 50 women were forced to trade sex for a job in the international Ebola aid operation in eastern DRC. The women have accused male aid workers from the World Health Organization and leading non-governmental organizations of abusing them. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA an investigation will seek to uncover the identities of the men who reportedly abused the women and determine whether the allegations are true.
If WHO staff, partners, or contractors are guilty of this allegation, WHO will take firm decision, disciplinary decision against them, immediate dismissal, or we can end our contracts with contractors or consultants.
Much of the alleged abuse reportedly occurred in the eastern city of Beni, which was the epicenter of a nearly two-year-long Ebola epidemic that killed 2,229 people before it ended in June. WHO currently is tackling another Ebola outbreak in Equateur province. The virus so far has infected 112 people, including 48 deaths. Shaib says WHO's director general takes the allegations of sexual abuse seriously and has ordered an immediate, thorough, and transparent investigation.
We are there to help vulnerable population, including women, and we will not tolerate this behavior from staff, contractors, or partners. Only the investigation will tell us who these perpetrators are, and we will do an investigation and go public about our findings.
WHO has many policies and mechanisms in place, including mandatory training programs to prevent sexual abuse. It also has set up hotlines where victims can report violations and seek help. Shaib says WHO recognizes even the best policies can go awry. She says every year WHO reports to the member states all misconduct about which it is informed, including fraud, corruption, and sexual abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Fighting between Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenian forces entered a fourth day Wednesday. This is the biggest eruption of violence since the 1994 ceasefire. The fighting has spread well beyond the borders of the enclave, threatening to spill into all-out war between the former Soviet republics of Azerbaijan and Armenia. International Edition's Steve Miller learns more about how the situation escalated to this point in a conversation via Skype with Lawrence Brohrer's Associate Fellow, Russia and Eurasia Program at Chatham House in London.
So over these 32 years, it's a conflict that ended with a decisive Armenian military victory in 1994. And there were quite intensive efforts in the late 1990s to resolve the conflict. Under the mediation of France, the United States, and Russia. Unfortunately, these efforts were unsuccessful at that time. And from the early 2000s, what we began to see is oil and gas revenues allowing Azerbaijan, which is the party that is, you know, very dissatisfied with the status quo, to rearm. And over the last 15 years, we've seen a regional arms race between the two countries. And since 2014, a series of escalations that go on periodically. Up to now, these have been contained at 4 and 5 days of violence. But I think that we may very well be seeing a new trend, a longer and more protracted conflict. So those are the long-term drivers, Azerbaijani dissatisfaction, the inability of diplomacy to come up with a solution that squares the circle of this conflict. And then more recently, we had an escalation in July 2020 that didn't go particularly well for Azerbaijan. And I think there's also a sense that, you know, these two countries have not had a good pandemic. We're entering into hard times ahead, and there may be a sense in which leaders want to rally populations around the flag and insulate themselves from protest in the coming months.
Diplomacy is always the preferred option towards violence, and there is some concern about the violence spilling over and drawing in Russia and Turkey. So is there a viable diplomatic effort going forward that can quell the violence now? As you said, typically it's lasted 4 or 5 days. We're in that period now.
Well, yesterday evening there was a meeting of the United Nations Security Council. They have affirmed the role of the Minsk Group. This is the body with the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe that's mandated to mediate in this conflict. It has three co-chairs, France, the United States, and Russia. And I assume that they will be, you know, intensifying their efforts in the coming days. However, I think we have to acknowledge that this escalation of violence is coming at a time of global distraction with the pandemic, with U.S. elections, and as we've highlighted, the support of Turkey to Azerbaijan. So I think it's going to be very difficult to bring diplomacy kind of back into focus. A lot depends on the outcomes on the battlefield and to what extent these strengthen or weaken the parties. I think it's going to be extremely challenging to bring the parties back to the negotiating table. In fact, yesterday there were announcements made that Azerbaijan rejects renewed negotiations with Armenia. So I think really a very deep challenge ahead for diplomacy.
What happens if Russia or Turkey become involved in this dispute?
Well, I think they already are involved. There's a lot of discussion about great powers being dragged into this conflict. They have insinuated themselves into the conflict. So I think we need to clarify that. I think what we are potentially seeing is the emergence of this conflict as another regional conflict in the Middle Eastern Eurasian neighborhood, where outside powers, regional powers that are looking to extend their foreign policy influence, are projecting power and testing one another. So Turkey's involvement reduces the risks for Azerbaijan of being isolated in the event of a larger conflict. It's a big test of Russia's hitherto largely unchallenged dominance over this conflict. I don't think that we'll be looking at open Russian-Turkish conflict. What we'll be seeing is that Armenia and Azerbaijan perhaps begin to become more and more like proxies for these outside power agendas.
Lawrence Brohrer's associate fellow, Russia and Eurasia program at Chatham House in London, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Jimmy Carter is celebrating his 95th birthday today. He is the first U.S. president to reach that milestone. Carter has no public celebrations planned, but in the coming days, will travel to Nashville with his wife, Rosalind, to help build houses for Habitat for Humanity. Carter was the 39th president of the United States. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. Clothes recycling is the pressure release valve of fast fashion, but it's buckling under COVID-19 curbs. Exporters are struggling, as well as traders and customers in often poorer nations who rely on a steady supply of used clothing. From Reuters, Lauren Anthony reports.
There's a multi-billion dollar global trade in secondhand clothing and recycled clothes, which helps keep us out of landfill, while keeping the wardrobes of the fashion savvy clear for next season's designs. Now, though, because of the pandemic, exporters, traders and customers who rely on a steady supply of used clothes are struggling. It's not that there isn't enough clothes. Ironically, there's too many, which has plummeted their value and led to huge backlogs in warehouses and thrift shops. And it's often those in poorer nations who are hit hardest. It's an issue Antonio Di Cavalho knows all too well, as the boss at a British textile recycling firm.
We keep going, but we couldn't sell any clothes during this lockdown. So the second-hand market in Europe and the rest of the clubs closed down. So we have been store. We have four warehouses in the UK. So it means we have full warehouse and during the time.
Recyclers and exporters have had to cut their prices to shift stock, as lockdown measures restrict movement and business slows in end markets abroad. For many, it's no longer commercially viable. They simply can't afford to move the merchandise. Meanwhile, recyclers are also removing clothes banks from streets, reducing collections and laying off workers to conserve cash, while stuck-at-home consumers clear out their wardrobes, adding to the pile-up. In the United States, for example, the value of exports from March to July fell 45% compared with the same period last year, so says government data. Up to a third of clothes donated in the U.S. ends up for sale in markets in the developing world. The consequences of the decline are reflected in open-air markets like this one in Kenya. Traders have been hit with shrinking supply, exacerbated by the government banning the import of used textiles in March over concerns they could carry coronavirus, and a drop in footfall due to people staying home. Secondhand clothes dealers like Nicholas Matissia are finding business sluggish, to say the least.
Before coronavirus came in, I've managed to sell at least 50 trousers a day. But now with coronavirus, even selling one a day has become difficult. You open in the morning and close in the evening in the same state without selling.
Lauren Anthony reporting. Australian-born singer Helen Reddy, who recorded a string of hits but shot to stardom in the 1970s with her rousing feminist anthem, I Am Woman, has died. AP Entertainment correspondent Oscar Wells Gabriel reports Reddy felt the song filled an important need. Yes, I'm white.
Helen Reddy said, when I Am Woman first came out, the American radio airwaves were filled with Stand By Your Man type lyrics.
They were being indoctrinated into this female slave type situation.
Soon after its release, Reddy said it was clear that I Am Woman would be a catalyst.
There was just this feeling in the air that things were changing.
And she noted in this 2013 interview that the song also struck a chord with men.
Bruce Lee used to work out sometimes to I Am Woman.
Helen Reddy died yesterday. She was 78 years old. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
In numbers too big to